Natural History. So welcome to you both.
Thank you. Good morning.
Maybe you could tell us and tell our audience a little bit about how you got interested in the topic and where your research into all of this began.
Why don't I start? When I was researching my book on GIs, gender, and domesticity, one of the things I wanted to know is what do GIs' attitudes about women, their ideas about women, tell us about the men themselves? And I thought one of the most compelling images of women was the image of Tokyo Rose. And so I began to investigate the rumors about Tokyo Rose and the real woman, Iva Deguri, who was later convicted of treason and kind of labeled Tokyo Rose. Dave and I are married. As I was working on this book, Dave was encouraging me to work more on communications, on the importance of radio to this story. And his work as public history director or assistant director at Rutgers and his work with the Rutgers Oral History Project really drew him into this topic and made us think about doing a collaborative project on this topic.
When I was at Rutgers, I helped to run a public history internship program, and one of the internship sites was an oral history collection project where Rutgers would go out and identify alumni who had served in the military and capture their oral histories. And there's about 400 online right now. The students at the end of the semester would invariably come back and say, "This is great. We're getting the real history, unvarnished history, before the historians get a hold of it. We're getting direct access to the experiences of the GIs." And then when you actually looked at the transcripts of these oral histories and what the veterans said about radio propaganda, you find a lot of myths. For example, if I can quote from a few of these oral histories, one man who was a dentist and serving in the Pacific talked about how Tokyo Rose hammered at the fact that they would become impotent if they took an anti-malarial drug. And Army intelligence later uncovered that this was indeed false and that Tokyo Rose never broadcast such a statement. Another common theme was that Tokyo Rose knew their units by name, their commanding officers, their locations, their destinations, and could predict impending attacks. And interestingly enough, when you look at other oral histories from Europe, you find the same themes repeated with respect to Lord Haha and Axis Sally. So there's some commonality between the radio broadcasts generally.
Well, I thought maybe we can take a step back a little bit and contextualize the whole nature of war propaganda during the time, and for our audience that who may not know very much about it. I thought maybe you could do that. Just set the stage for when did Japan, when did Germany and the U.S. get involved with radio propaganda?
Sure. Radio broadcasting was a fairly new phenomenon, obviously, originating in the 1920s. So World War II was really the first radio broadcast war, if you will. And both sides employed what was called white propaganda, which was broadcasts directly to enemy troops and enemy civilians. If you were a British civilian, you obviously knew that Lord Haha was broadcasting for the Germans. Every belligerent country had shortwave and AM radio stations broadcasting to enemy populations and enemy troops. Then there was also black propaganda, which I find to be very interesting. Black propaganda was essentially radio stations set up by, say, the British, but purporting to be German, and vice versa. Germany had five different transmitters aimed at Britain, claiming to be British. One was aimed at workers, called Workers' Challenge. Another one was aimed at pacifists. Another one was aimed at Scottish nationalists, and so forth. And the British countered with several black transmitters of their own as well. So both sides invested a great deal of hope and effort and time and money in these propaganda broadcasts, hoping that they would have meaningful effects on the war. And their effects were a lot more ambiguous than both sides hoped. It's not clear that radio propaganda had any meaningful effect on the outcome of the war.
how many listeners were there to these broadcasts? I mean, did they know whether their broadcasts were reaching large numbers of people or small numbers of people?
In fact, the BBC and Mass Observation, which was a British social research project, surveyed listeners, particularly in the period between November 1939 and March 1940. And they found, BBC found, that one out of three households on any given night tuned in to Lord Haha, in other words, William Joyce's broadcasts. The Army, the U.S. Army, because there are different audiences for these broadcasts. Lord Haha was broadcast to British civilians and soldiers. Tokyo Rose and Axis Sally broadcasts were broadcast to Allied soldiers, particularly American soldiers. The U.S. Army surveyed soldiers about their listening habits in 1943 and 1944, and both in Europe and in the Pacific, as well as in China, Burma, India, enemy broadcasts had a really significant listenership. About 20% of American soldiers in New Guinea in the fall of 1943 listened to Radio Tokyo broadcasts. In fact, broadcasts were a big source of entertainment. They would be put out over the public address system before a movie, for example, with the whole group of men congregated together listening to American broadcasts, to Japanese broadcasts, and then watching a Hollywood movie.
So there would be no attempts to restrict access to these broadcasts?
No, there were not. Not in the Pacific that I know of. Basically, commanders who were interviewed by the FBI in 1945 and 1946 told the FBI that they thought the broadcasts were harmless, and in fact, they were a really good source of entertainment for the troops.
Interestingly enough, the German and Italian governments prohibited their citizens from listening to any foreign broadcasts, and the penalties could be quite severe. It's not clear, again, what effect this had on listenership. There was a movement in England in 1940 to enact some sort of legal restriction on listening to German broadcasts, but that turned out to be unworkable and also unwise in a democracy. So the British government and public opinion leaders turned to essentially peer pressure to discourage people from listening to German broadcasts.
Now, I know that the United States had a monitoring service, a monitoring division for all these foreign broadcasts. What was the aim of this monitoring service? What were they trying to monitor? What did they do with the information?
One of the things they wanted to do is they just wanted to understand what sort of propaganda was being sent to American troops, the Foreign Broadcast Intelligence Service you're talking about, which was part of the FCC at the time. They wanted to know, they provided policymakers with an understanding of what the what was being broadcast, of what the major themes were, and they even, toward the end, tried to figure out who Tokyo Rose was. And an interesting story is, the Foreign Broadcast Intelligence Service, like all of the intelligence services, realized toward the end of the war that there was no Tokyo Rose, that in fact stories about Tokyo Rose, which were considered potentially dangerous because they gave up security information, were stories that were generated by the men.
You're actually anticipating. This part of the story is one of the most fascinating part of your research, mm-hmm. and so I want to leave it till a little later on.
Okay,
Let's build on the foundations.
Sorry.
So they're being monitored. These broadcasts are being monitored, and they're mm-hmm. being monitored because there was some concern about what was being heard. Obviously, by the morale. I was astounded by the number of psychologists and psychiatrists who are being employed by governments, and I assume that you know, the German government and in Japan, they might have been doing this. I don't know. But the number that were being used to analyze the impact of these broadcasts on the population, on soldiers and the general population, there must have been a great amount of concern with morale.
Certainly. Certainly, the Army was almost obsessed with soldiers' morale during World War II. And in fact, that's why you have the soldier surveys, is to find out what soldiers think and what makes them unhappy. And also as sort of an opportunity for them to vent about issues that they're unhappy about. The goal of soldier surveys was, in fact, to find out what soldiers thought in order to develop policies that would make soldiers happy, to improve morale, to improve, you know, enthusiasm for the war effort.
Now, from the perspective of the Germans mm-hmm. at the time, I mean, this was the propaganda machine of all time. And the emphasis on radio was, from my reading, not just your own work, but other works. This is incredible, the amount of emphasis. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that and about how they selected these broadcasters, Lord Haw Haw, as came, and others later in Japan as well.
Sure. A couple things to say about that. First of all, radio researchers and psychologists on the Allied side were very much concerned about radio propaganda, because they believed that radio propaganda had been instrumental in the fall of France, as well as the fall of Czechoslovakia and Austria before that. In other words, that radio propaganda had softened up enemy populations and weakened the will to resist. So that's why there was a lot of emphasis on monitoring these broadcasts and developing a counter-propaganda arm of the military and the civilian governments. Joseph Goebbels left diaries, and those are available in any major library. And in his diaries, he has many, many entries about the effectiveness of German radio propaganda. The Germans were getting British newspapers and had some sense that the British public was listening to German broadcasts. Goebbels in particular thought that Lord Haw Haw was a very effective broadcaster. So the German leadership invested a lot of faith in the power of radio propaganda to weaken the will of enemy populations. Part of the reason the Nazis invested a lot of hope in this medium is because of their success in attaining political power in Germany in the 1930s through various propaganda methods, including broadcasting.
Yeah, I remember reading in your piece that Goebbels was saying that how effective their broadcasting propaganda was and how Lord Haw Haw was on everybody's lips at the time.
Yes.
And that he was also interrogating British prisoners of war. Mm. And he was getting some feedback from that in fact, that they were having a real impact on soldiers.
Right. Goebbels was interested. He interviewed British POWs not only to get a sense of what the white propaganda effectiveness was like with respect to Lord Haw Haw, for example, but also the effectiveness of the black propaganda stations. And Goebbels, again, believed that the black propaganda stations, Workers' Challenge, the new British broadcasting station, and so forth, were as effective, if not more effective, than the white propaganda broadcast from Germany.
Yeah, Dave, can you tell us, or Anne, a little bit more? We've been talking about Lord Haw Haw. Who was he? Where did he come from? What was in his broadcasts?
William Joyce, who became known as Lord Haw Haw, even though he wasn't initially the voice who the British named Lord Haw Haw, was actually born in the U.S., to parents who were naturalized citizens of the U.S. They were Irish, and they moved back to Ireland with him when he was around 3 years old. He, as a very young age, in college, became involved in fascist politics. During the 1930s, he was a very effective speaker for Oswald Mosley's British Union of Fascists. When the BUF was starting to break apart, he formed a splinter group, which was a very pro-Nazi splinter group before German invasion of Poland. Just before the German invasion of Poland in August 1939, he left with his wife, his second wife, to go to Germany, and he began broadcasting really just weeks after he arrived in Germany. And he basically broadcast very fearful propaganda. He promised, brutal attacks, very effective attacks using new, scary weapons. Although initially, British listeners did not know to whom they were listening. Very quickly, Joyce was identified by his ex-wife, and photographs would begin to appear in the press the following year. And he was an intimidating-looking man who did not look at all like the Lord Ha-Ha that, the British press, because Lord Ha-Ha was a big sensation in 1939. He was reported on in the British press, talked about on the streets. He was not the sort of man Lord Ha-Ha was supposed to be, which was sort of an upper-class twit. He was a pretty, pretty tough-looking black shirt. He was a rough-and-tumble fascist with a big facial scar from his mouth to his ear.
Do you know what led to his selection by the Germans as a propagandist?
I think he was someone who was eager to serve, and I think he was someone who had proved himself a very effective speaker even before he went to Germany. He did not have, as far as I know, any previous radio experience, but he proved to be one of the most effective broadcasters they had.
Do we want to maybe listen to him a little bit? Is this a good time?
Sure.
Okay, well, let's take a short pause, really short, and listen to a few minutes of Lord Ha-Ha.
Here is William Joyce to give tonight's views on the news.
The news from the Eastern Front today is not very copious. On the whole, the present phase of the fighting is of a preparatory nature. The Soviets are trying to consolidate their successes, and the measures are developing. And the issue immediately at stake is whether European civilization shall survive or be completely overwhelmed by the hordes of Bolshevism, savage and barbarous in character, but equipped with the most modern and scientific means of military conquest.
Now, that's just a really short segment, and the quality obviously is not very good. Partially, I guess, from because the monitoring stations were not.
Where does the audio come from?
The audio comes from the National Archives, ultimately. Most of these collections come from the National Archives and from the agencies, the government agencies that were monitoring these stations. And there are hundreds, thousands of hours of these there. And they're available elsewhere. They're available on the internet, widely available on CDs as well.
Many people have captured them and recycled them.
Yeah. So that was a little bit of Lord Ha-Ha. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about some of the other personalities who were selected by the Germans and by the Japanese.
Another famous broadcaster for the Germans was Axis Sally. Was nicknamed Axis Sally by American troops. She was actually Mildred Gillers, who was romantically involved with another German radio broadcaster named Otto Koischwitz, who broadcast on shortwave to the U.S. under the moniker Mr. OK. It's not clear exactly what motivated Mildred Gillers to broadcast for the Germans. The most plausible explanation was that she did sympathize with Nazi ideals to a large extent, and also being romantically involved with Mr. OK was also a factor. She was also convicted of treason, or she was convicted of treason after the war, served time in the same prison as Iva Taguri, who was convicted for treason as Tokyo Rose. After her release from prison, she returned to Ohio and taught music at a girls' school. She had her moment in the sun, so to speak, during the war, and then basically faded away after release from prison.
Well, one thing to add to that is she is someone with theatrical ambitions. She moved to New York City to try to make it, never did, then kind of, wandered around Europe, ended up in Germany, lost her job at Berlitz, ended up broadcasting and, you know, in fact, found the stardom, I think, that she was looking for in the U.S.
Now, did these folks, I know that William Joyce obviously had ideological affection proclivities for fascism. How about Mildred Gillers and Iva Tuguri and some of the others? Were they also drawn to the ideology of the folks that they worked for?
In a lot of cases, yeah, there is an appeal of the ideology. There's a lot of anti-Semitism in, you know, that you find among the Americans and the Brits who broadcast for Germany during the war. In the case of Iva Tuguri and a lot of the Americans who broadcast for Japan, you find some sympathy among them for a Japanese cause. A lot of them are second-generation Japanese-Americans who ended up in Japan. But a lot of the broadcasters and the most popular broadcasters for Radio Tokyo, those who participated on the Zero Hour, were prisoners of war, or in Iva Tuguri's case, someone who was stranded in Japan during the war and who by all accounts, did not feel much of an affinity with the Japanese war effort or Japanese culture.
Fascinating. I wonder, maybe we should listen to some of those, some of the other voices as well. Whom do you think we should listen to next?
Why don't we start with Axis Sally, Mildred Gillers?
Okay, let me go to that, set that up. We're ready to go.
This is Berlin calling. Berlin calling the American mothers, wives, and sweethearts. And I'd just like to say, girls, that when Berlin calls, it pays to listen. When Berlin calls, it pays to listen in. Because there's an American girl sitting at the microphone every Tuesday evening at the same time with a few words of truth to her country women back home. Girls, you all know, of course, by now that it's a very serious situation. And there must be some reason for my being here in Berlin. Some reason why I'm not sitting at home with you at the little sewing bees, knitting socks for our men over in French North Africa. Yes, girls, there is a reason. And it's this. It's because I'm not on the side of President Roosevelt. I'm not on the side of Roosevelt and his Jewish friends and his British friends. Because I've been brought up to be a 100% American girl. Conscious of everything American, conscious of her friends, conscious of her enemies. And the enemies are precisely those people who are fighting against Germany today, and in case you don't know it, indirectly against America too. Because a defeat for Germany would mean a defeat for America. Believe me, it would be the very beginning of the end of America and all of her civilization. And that's why, girls, I'm staying over here and having little heart-to-heart talks with you once a week. I know they're awfully short, and there's not much that one can say. But at least I'm so convinced that it's the truth, and I'm sure that truth will win. And besides that, you know, I'm in constant touch with your men over here, interned in Germany as prisoners of war. And I'm sure you'll be very happy to get some news of them from time to time. And I'll do my best to transmit that to you just as often as I can. And now, girls, just last week, in speaking to one American boy, he told us then about the films which he had seen in America. Films which dealt with the barbarism of Germany and of the treatment which he deals out to American prisoners and all of that sort of thing. And that's why I'm just going to put all the energy I can into these few moments I have with you each week and try to get you to see the light of day and to let you realize that you're on the wrong side of the fence. And now, girls, I do think it would be nice to listen to a little music, don't you? The sort of music which conveys the thoughts which are in the hearts of your men over in French South Africa today. Over there in the dry and hot desert, they're dreaming now of a lazy day at home, a lazy day when spring and summer meet, a lazy day when green fields are whispering of home sweet home. And now here it is, conveying all the thoughts in the hearts of those men so far away from their mothers and wives today.
No longer lonely, the towns of the
There's a lot in that. How do you analyze the content? What are the themes that you get out of that? And who is she as she talks to the girls?
Mm-hmm. This was a German broadcast over shortwave aimed at the American home front. One of the reasons that people listened to enemy broadcast in England and in the United States was for news about POWs. And if you noticed in that broadcast, the announcer intimated that she was in touch with POWs and interned civilians. So one major motivation for people to listen to these broadcasts was to hear news about loved ones who were captured in combat or loved ones who were interned as civilians. The Germans actually had a station called Jerry's Front in Italy and distributed leaflets, dropped leaflets on Allied troops. And you could fill out the leaflet and have a short message in case you were captured, a short message that would be broadcast to your family over German radio. Another reason that people listened to broadcasts, which was not apparent from this one, but I think it's worth pointing out, particularly Lord Haha, was British civilians wanted to know what places had been bombed during the Blitz. And the BBC did not broadcast the names of the cities that the German bombers had attacked because they didn't want to give the Germans information about whether their raids were successful. So British civilians would often tune into German radio to find out what towns had been raided. And a final reason that people listened was curiosity or wanting to keep up with the news or get another view of the news. So there are a variety of motivations for people to listen to these broadcasts. And I think the Axis Ally broadcast is a good indication of what listeners could expect to hear.
Earlier, you mentioned the kind of assessment and analysis that was done with GIs of what they were listening to. Is there anything comparable that we know about how these were received on the home front?
The British home front actually has some very good information. There was a sociology project called Mass Observation run out of, I believe, the University of Sussex that essentially worked for the British government during the war, gathering data on popular morale. And they asked participants to keep a diary starting in the summer of 1939 and going on for a few years. And diarists were asked at one point in 1940 to record their impressions about radio broadcasting in general and German propaganda in particular. So those diaries and the mass observation records are a very good source for a social history of wartime radio listening.
Did you want to add something?
Yeah. The BBC as well conducted mm-hmm. listener research, and those materials are also available.
I think this might be a good time to pause for our audio question of the week, and we'll return to our conversation and get into the whole theme of the imaginary propaganda and what happened to these radio traitors.